What would David Livingstone say to us today? Isaiah 6 verse 8. Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? Then I said, here am I, send me. Frontline Fellowship has for over 40 years sought to be Bible-based, Christ-centered, Africa-faced, seeking to serve the persecuted churches working in restricted access areas throughout Africa. Our vision is Africa for Christ. So here we are at a Great Commission course. We've been running Great Commission courses for 24 years. And the whole purpose of the Great Commission course is to keep the main thing, which is the Great Commission of our Lord Jesus Christ. To seek first God's kingdom and his righteousness. To make disciples of all nations. To teach obedience to all things the Lord has commanded. And you'll notice the symbol of a Great Commission course is boots. Boots laced up. Feet shod for the preparation of the gospel of peace. And of course, boots, you know, Table Mountain, hikes, mountains, we're thinking Nuba Mountains, and whatever other challenges there are to overcome. So, Dr. David Livingstone is an example of excellence. His life, his legacy, his literature continue to speak to us today. The challenge of David Livingstone is most relevant to our times. So if Dr. David Livingstone was here today at Livingstone House, at the Great Commission course, what do you think he might say to us? Well, we don't need to guess. We have his writings, we have his published statements available. We can know exactly what David Livingstone would say to us today. It's what he said to the people of his day. The salvation of men ought to be the chief desire and aim of every Christian. All men have the right to hear God's word. No nation ought to hoard God's word like a miser. Can the love of Christ not carry the missionary where the slave trade carries the trader? If you have men who will only come if they know that there's a good road, I don't want them. I want men who will come even if there's no road at all. A mission agency had written to him asking if he knew of a good road to where he was because they had men who'd like to join him. And his response was, if they need a road, I don't want them. I want people to come even if there's no road at all. He wrote in a letter to his sisters, we must be uncommon Christians. That is, eminently holy, devoted servants of the Most High. Let us seek that selfishness be extirpated. Let us seek that pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind. Every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will crucified. That holiness to the Lord may be engraved on the heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct. We still have a debt of gratitude to Jesus, and there is no greater privilege on earth than, after having our own chains broken off, to go forth and proclaim liberty to the captives, the opening of prison to them who are bound. Dr. David Livingstone was inspired by an optimistic view of the future. Like most of the missionaries of the 19th century, Livingstone held to an eschatology of victory. Discoveries and inventions are cumulative, he wrote, filling the earth with the glory of the Lord. All nations will sing his glory and bow before him. Our work and fruit are cumulative. We work towards a new state of things. Future missionaries will be rewarded by conversions for every sermon. We are their pioneers and helpers. Let them not forget the watchman of the night, who worked in all this gloom and no evidence of success in the way of conversions shares our path. They will doubtless have more light than we. But we serve our master earnestly, and we proclaim the same gospel they will do. A quiet audience today, he wrote in his diary. The seed is being sown, the least of all seeds now, but it will grow into a mighty tree. It is as if it were a small stone cut out of a mountain, but it will fill the whole earth. We work for a glorious future which we are not destined to see. The golden age which has not yet been but which will yet be. We are only morning stars shining in the dark, but the glorious morn will come, the good time coming yet. The dominion has been given to the power by the power of commerce and population unto the people of the saints of the Most High. This is an everlasting kingdom, a little stone cut out of the mountain without hands, which will cover the whole earth. For this time we work by different agencies, God, the great ruler, is bringing all things into focus. Jesus is gathering all things to himself, and he is daily becoming more and more the center of this world's hopes and of this world's fears. Today, there are over 500 million people in Africa who claim to be Christians. According to Operation World, this includes 150 million Protestants, 50 million Anglicans, 140 million Charismatics, 60 million Pentecostals, and 100 million Independents. Now, it's extraordinary. David Livingstone plowed in stony ground and he sowed the gospel seed that has produced this great harvest. When David Livingstone first came to Africa, there were possibly only 5 million Christians in all of Africa. Today there's 500 million who claim to be Christians. Psalm 22, all the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall turn and worship before you, for the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. Now, the life and the legacy of David Livingstone changed my life. As a new Christian, I imbibed many of the presuppositions and tendencies of churches in the 1970s. I read The Late Great Planet Earth, and there's a new world coming, and Satan is alive and well on planet Earth, and other date-setting end times rapture fever publications. I was saved, I loved the Lord, I was enthusiastically involved in evangelism, but my understanding of biblical doctrine was actually quite shallow. I imbibed the prevailing prejudice against Calvinism. I was convinced we were living in the last days, if not the last minutes. Therefore, I could not at the time consider marriage or children. There just wasn't enough time. I could not allow myself to be distracted by worldly matters like family and raising children. I need to devote the last few days on earth to snatching souls from the fire. That was my conviction. The rapture was coming surely before the end of that year. I was completely closed to the idea of theological training. What's the point? The Lord will have come before I could finish my studies, I thought. Better to stay in the field, winning souls in these last few days remaining. Then I read The Puritan Hope, Revival Interpretation of Prophecy by Ian Murray, published by Banner of Truth, who publishes a lot of great old classics. This book informed me that all of the pioneer missionaries of the 19th century missionary movement were Calvinist and post-millennial. Now, I had no idea what post-millennialism was, but when I read that the father of modern missions, William Carey, and the best friend Africa ever had, Dr. David Livingstone, were both Reformed and post-millennial, I determined to read up on these matters. Earlier, I'd read a small, thin, modern biography on David Livingstone, and it didn't seem too extraordinary because, like most modern books, it was sanitized. It was abbreviated. All controversial, politically incorrect facts had been removed. The modern, censored version of Livingstone life did not mention the ravages of the Islamic slave trade, which David Livingstone confronted, documented, and fought against. It left out his Calvinist convictions and his post-millennial eschatology of victory. Don't want to confuse people with these facts. The modern biographies left out the fact that David Livingstone came to Africa in 1841 with very advanced weaponry, a six-barreled revolver, double-barreled rifle. His violent confrontations with Islamic slave raiders, his bold initiatives to set thousands of captives free, was also apparently deemed too controversial to include in these modern, sanitized, abridged versions of Livingstone's life. However, I've always been a bookworm, and I have a love for history, and I'm finding most of the books available in the average bookshop today to be quite shallow and predictable. I've developed a preference for scouring through second-hand bookshops, finding rare old first editions of these missionaries and pioneers. I was reading Livingstone's missionary travels as I was following in much of his footsteps in Cape Province of Mozambique in Zambezi Valley in 1989. And that was when I and the medical team that I was leading were captured by Russian forces and imprisoned in SNAS, security prison in Mashava in Maputo. What I learned from the writings and from the exemplary life of the extraordinary legacy of David Livingstone transformed my life and ministry. So what did I learn from David Livingstone? I learned the importance of discipline. He was disciplined in reading and in exercise. He was self-controlled. David Livingstone abstained from alcohol for life. He was temperate. He was duty-orientated. He was hard-working. Livingstone's work ethic is a rebuke to us all. From age 10, he worked a 14-hour day, 6 days a week, walking an average of 34 kilometers a day, much of this in a crawling or stooping position amongst or under the machinery or bounced over it. Imagine the tremendous physical training this work in the cotton mills was for his later transcontinental expeditions throughout Africa. And he did his work in the cotton mills in esteemed heat and humidity, considered essential for the production of thread. David had a hunger for knowledge. He is 10. At age 10, he bought a book on Latin, Rudiments of Latin. Can you imagine? Less than 10% of the children who walked in the cotton mills ever learned to read or write. In fact, not only did David learn to read and write, he taught himself Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. Every night after work, he'd attend a night school, 8 to 10 p.m. Then at home, he'd study off until midnight. And every morning began at 5:30 a.m. and his workday at 6 a.m. The whistle blew at 5:30 for everyone to get up, and by 6 they all had to be at work for 14 hours. And before we depart from this cotton mill picture here in Blantyre, there was a story that we only know recently because it was uncovered in the archives in the London Missionary Society attic in London. David Livingstone, it was before he turned 10, so he would have been 8 or 9, and he was lying on the banks of the river reading a book when a cry startled him, and he saw a young girl was playing with her brother, young brother, a toddler, in a boat and had lost the oars. And the boat was being pulled towards the paddle wheels, which would have surely crushed the boat and killed both children. David plunged into the icy waters. He rescued both children, and he never said a word about it. And the only reason we know about this is that the parents came later to Livingstone's family to thank him for what he had done. And when the father of David Livingstone was required to give a testimonial about his son, he wrote to the Mission Society, and he mentioned this amongst many other things. And David Livingstone never mentioned that incident the whole of his life in any of his books or writings. But anyway, we now know about that. When he was studying medicine and theology, David Livingstone would walk from Blantyre to Glasgow, refusing every offer of a ride by horse carts that were passing by, because he preferred the four-hour walk, often in snow and winter, this is Scotland, in order to strengthen his muscles for his chosen career in missions. He didn't want to get soft. Now, Livingstone never accepted charity. Although he was brought up in the poorest of circumstances, where his family of seven were forced to live in a single room, this room, 10 feet by 14 feet without any electricity, any plumbing, or any running water. Now, the picture we showed, the drawing earlier, was a bit imaginative, showing him sitting at a desk and his mother opening a door, why are you still up? Well, it couldn't have actually happened because that's the parents' bed, the other mattresses are under the bed, and they were pulled out, so the whole floor was filled with mattresses. And all seven had to sleep in this one room. There was no running water at all. And I've read people saying that he was given a bursary to study the project. How could he? They didn't have bursaries back in the 1830s. And he probably wouldn't have accepted if they did. He worked. He saved up to put himself through both medical school and theological college. David was the first worker from the cotton mills to receive a university education. And nobody gave it to him. He earned it. He passed with high honours, receiving his doctorate from the Royal Faculty of Physicians and Surgeons, November 1840. Ordained as a congregational minister, 20th of November 1840. Against all odds, he achieved something far more than anyone would have thought possible for someone born into such a poverty-stricken and disadvantaged background. This is where his family lived, and I've had people saying, this was Livingstone's house. Well, not quite. This is the tenement where 24 families lived. Dave's family had one of the rooms at the top of the third floor. And every bit of water came from this one pump in the middle of the courtyard. And his brother or him had to carry every drop of water they need for cooking, washing, cleaning, up those spiral staircases to the third floor. I must say, having running water in one's home is certainly a great advantage. When you've been in the field, you see how many hours most young girls in Africa spend most of the day fetching water or wood. That's a fact. David Livingstone didn't wait for someone else to open up Africa or to invent four-wheel drive vehicles or to build the roads or the bridges. He drew the first maps of the Zambezi. He did not have an attitude of entitlement. David Livingstone had a Protestant work ethic. In fact, this map, which he drew of the Zambezi, when it's compared to the satellite maps we've got today, accurate. And he did this without the technology we've got today. I mean, he was working out the altitude by boiling water for the tea and having his thermometer in to see at the precise temperature it boiled at. Martin was now doing the calculations, using a sextant to work out the longitudes and latitudes at night from the stars. He worked out, walking alongside the rivers, hacking his way through the jungle, a map of the whole Zambezi, which is accurate. The maps of Africa before David Livingstone were pretty embarrassingly inaccurate and pathetic and imaginative and just unbelievable, and you've got to be kidding. And these were serious maps that were out there. And how do you like this one? The Nile coming right down to Botswana and South Africa in Transvaal, Mount Mbuni, which is why when you go to the Kruger National Park, they've got there the Nile crocodile. But it's got nothing to do with the Nile. They called it the Nile crocodile because when they saw these crocodiles by the Limpopo and the Sabi River, they said, these must be the Nile crocodiles. This is the source of the Nile. Well, they were wrong. Just like why, when you go in Cape Town, you find a place called Tiger Valley. We've never had tigers in Africa. But it's called Tiger Valley because the original people looked and thought that those spotted creatures were tigers, but they were leopards. So it should be leopard fillet. But anyway, just to remind us the fact that a lot of people get things wrong. Even in the 1500s, they still think the mountains, moon, and Nile, straight down to, that's roughly Zimbabwe and Zambia and Malawi, I suppose. And when Livingstone arrived here, this was the map of Africa. There are a lot of blank spaces, very, very blank spaces. But Livingstone filled it in. The general consensus of the geographers of the time is that the center of Africa is one big desert. And David Livingstone proved them wrong. He said, no, Africa in the middle is full of plateaus, and lakes and mountains and rivers, and he filled it in. And what he didn't fill in, Henry Morton Stanley did. Africa was far more complex than just one big desert on the inside, which I suppose people thought, well, you know, there's Sahara and the Namib Desert, so the whole of Central Africa has got to be one big desert, right? Wrong. And Livingstone's the one who proved them wrong and who mapped it out. Well, in 1855, as David Livingstone was travelling down the Zambezi, going from its source, following it all the way along, he came across this massive, massive pillar of smoke, water vapour, something. And he asked the local people, what is it? And they said, Musi Oyatanya, the smoke that thunders. Well, what makes the smoke thunder? Jinn, spirits. Well, have you ever been there?
No.
Do you know anyone who's been there? No. I know many people get quite worked up over the suggestion that David Livingstone discovered Victoria Falls. Well, he's certainly the first one to have mapped it, named it, made it known to the world, and measured it, and so on. But maybe he was one of the first human beings to see it. It's possible. Because, and we'll show you now, the local people are too scared to go near there because of the thunder, the roar, the noise, the smoke. And he found greater concentrations of wildlife around Victoria Falls than he'd seen anywhere else in 24 years of walking across Africa. It was a sanctuary. Why would it be a sanctuary from hunters? Well, they were maybe too superstitious to go there. At any rate, Livingstone got a canoe, rented a canoe, and he went towards this ever, and he must have known, this was getting faster and faster, it was quite a risk to take a canoe, and he beached himself on that, Livingstone Island, we call it. And forget these two men standing with the spears around there. That's a bit of imagination somebody put in later. He did this alone. But he crawled to the edge, and he looked out over a scene that he said, angels in flight must have gazed at such scenes at creation. And he came prepared. This is it. Livingstone Island. Beached his canoe there, just as well he didn't miss. And he let down a weighted, lead-weighted string rope. And he measured 310 feet high. That's it. I mean, can you imagine crawling to the end of that and letting down the lid? Oh, this is another view. Would you have been happy to do this? There's the first person there. Crawl to the edge, drop down this lead weight. And, yep, I mean, that's what it looks like. if you use a drone or a helicopter today, that's quite precipitous. And Livingston measured Victoria Falls. This is, in fact, from his first edition, you can see, he paced it. Victoria Falls, 1,860 yards wide. That's what it is. 310 feet deep. That's what it is. How did he work that out? I mean, it's not like he could have exactly paced it out. It's a waterfall, for goodness sakes. You can't pace out a waterfall. How did he do that? With the other ravines, he paced 400 feet deep, and then 150 paces between, and so on and so forth. So this is his first sketches at the time that Livingston used to be able to measure the falls. He did more than that. He sketched it. Now, we've got the original first editions. Except that there is no elevation that gives you this perspective. This is roughly where the Victoria Falls Hotel would be, and it's not that high up, I assure you. It's way down. How did he get that? He had to project himself, imagination. It's hard enough to paint what's there or sketch what's there. He sketched what it would have been if he was a bit higher to give people a bit of depth perception. And that's pretty accurate. This is Victoria Falls. This is just spectacular. Okay, now we've got helicopters and drones, but he did better. There's no elevation from where he could have got this perspective of the different the cataracts and then the different ravines flowing out of it. But he sort of anticipated what it would be and drew from memory and imagination from having walked through this terrain so people could get a perception of the depth and this extraordinary labyrinth of the Zambezi River following after it comes over Victoria Falls. And he was accurate. It's an amazing tribute to a man with that kind of vision. Well, Victoria Falls was named after, of course, Queen Victoria. We've actually got these portraits at the entrance to Livingston House and upper room here, prints from the original paintings done by Thomas Baines. So Thomas Baines was the greatest artist of the Victorian era. And Queen Victoria sent him on Livingston's second great mission to Africa to paint the falls that was named after her. And this is what he, a few years later, painted, showing vast amounts, herds of animals there at Victoria Falls, who are now being hunted. But there was still a great sanctuary of wildlife there at that stage, just again testifying to the fact that it was a place that was something of a sanctuary for many years, centuries probably. The view from the Zimbabwe side of the falls, main falls, and the rainbow, which is always there, and the crevices, this is the view you'd get from the Zimbabwe side. And millions of litres of water comes plunging over every second in the rainy season. It's phenomenal. And let me tell you, people have gone over the edge. I've asked the locals, do people ever fall over the falls? Oh, all the time. I said, tourists as well. Oh, yes. Why don't you ever read about it? Oh, no, that would be bad for tourism. So people do, and you've seen people doing selfies right at the edge and sitting in a sort of rock pool by the edge. Anyway, you can understand why people go over the edge. I remember going there for the first time in 1972, and that just the year before, an American film crew, director, producer, camera, and a whole lot went right over. They got too close to the edge, they were filming something, and before they knew it, the current just sucked them in a motorboat right over the edge. Gone. Finished. Kaput. Yeah. They must have got some great footage on the way down, but it wasn't recovered. And, I mean, you can imagine, 310 feet. And you've got tons of water coming on top of it. It's just so. I mean, this is nothing to play with. Well, 100 years later, on the 16th of November, 1955, in southern Rhodesia, they unveiled this iconic statue to David Livingston in memory of him and on the centenary of his naming, discovering, sketching, measuring, making known to the world, Victoria Falls. And this, I think, is the picture many of us have of Livingston. Just what an excellent work in bronze. To achieve what he did, Livingston was decisive, goal-oriented, and inflexible. Reformed theology put doctrinal steel in his backbone. He was a man of integrity. He was a man of his word. He meant what he said, and he said what he meant. He walked thousands of miles across difficult and dangerous terrain to return his porters to the village. So earlier he travelled with his wife and children. All of his children got sick and his wife got sick and one of his children died in Botswana. He was heavily criticised for having the irresponsibility to take his family with him on a mission. So he took them, walked them to Cape Town, put them on ship to go back to be looked after by his family in Britain, and then he walked back and he went all the way through South Africa, Botswana, Zambia, to Angola. And when he got, he discovered a whole lot in the way, and after 2 years he'd reached Luanda, the capital of Angola. And there was the British ship, the Forerunner, ready to take him to England. And he would not do it because he knew Portugal still engaged in slavery. All European powers abolished the slave trade in 1815, but not Portugal. And he's in Portuguese territory. And he was afraid that his men may not be able to find the way back to the village and that they could get captured by other slave trading groups, if not the Portuguese. So he decided to take the men who had helped him on this 2-year expedition back to the village. He could have been in that boat and with his family in a few months. That's the man of integrity he was. David Livingstone understood the power of prayer. He had Holy Spirit fire in his heart, soul, and mind, and he prayed and he sang the Psalms daily. He loved the Psalms, which was very Scottish too. He had a great love for God's creation, for nature, and for wildlife. And his books are filled with intricate sketches and fascinating details on animals and vegetation, like the eland, the largest antelope in Africa, and the hippopotamus, and the waterbuck, and the baobab trees, which you can make rope out of, and sandals, and so many good things come out of the baobab tree. And the different tools used by the local people, the double-handed Angola hoe, the different body piercing tattoos, earrings that people wore, and the bangles around their legs, and the different hairstyles and beard styles, and the strange different musical instruments such as, what would you call this, the marimba playing, and the new moon celebrations and dances that were observed by different tribes, and how the bushmen would take ostrich eggs and hollow them out and use them as water bottles, and stuff some grass into as a plug for the top, and they'd take these in nets and they'd bury them in the desert in different places to have water when they're coming back at different times. And he saw massive amounts of wildlife, huge herds. I mean, imagine the size of the herds in Africa before weapons like firearms were seen in Africa, and just how many animals he saw. And none of us would have seen the kinds of sights of wildlife that he would have seen back in the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s. And David Livingstone took down the details, observed the details about the different animals and the characteristics. His books are filled with fascinating details on animals, vegetation, plants, geology, all sorts. The fastest animal in Africa, engineered for speed, the cheetah. And he was able to give the details of him. And the regal king of the beasts, the lion, the most powerful, courageous animal. In fact, David Livingstone foolishly got talked into shooting a lion by some chief who obviously wants the lion skin, said this lion was killing his goats, which is highly unlikely. There's so many antelope around. He wouldn't waste his time on goat meat. But anyway, David Livingstone shot the lion. The lion was lying, minding his own business. David Livingstone shot the lion. The lion took the slug, went up and broke Livingstone's shoulder, shook him like a dog shakes a rat before he fell down dead himself. And so Livingstone said for the rest of his life he regretted that foolish action, because it hurt his whole life, that aching shoulder. And that's how they also identified his bones when he came back from the lion's teeth marks in his shoulder. He saw the great, largest animal in the world, land animal, the elephants. And he also observed, like many missionaries who went there later, there's snow on the equator in Africa. And people in Europe said, what liars these missionaries are. Everyone knows there can't be snow on the equator in Africa. There's no snow in Africa. Don't be ridiculous. And, well, photography later proved the missionaries were right, but for centuries, for almost a century, they were believed to be lying about there being snow on the equator in Africa. Of course, Mount Kilimanjaro and Mount Kenya. Well, David Livingstone was inspired by post-millennial eschatology of victory. He had a kingdom vision. David Livingstone understood the greatness of the Great Commission. He worked to comprehensively fulfill the Great Commission, ministering to body, mind, and spirit. As a medical doctor, he ministered to the body. As a teacher, he ministered to the mind. And as a preacher of the gospel, he ministered to the spirit. Wherever he went, he used his medical knowledge and training, his breadth of reading and his learning and his deep faith and his knowledge of the Holy Scriptures to enrich and empower the people of Africa. In fact, this is the flyleaf of his book, Missionary Research, Travels and Research in South Africa. Instead of putting the lion or the rhino on the cover, on the flyleaf, was he put the tsetse fly. He said the tsetse fly is the biggest obstacle. It kills all horses. Now, if you've seen pictures of David Livingstone traveling into Africa on a horse, imagination. He couldn't do that because tsetse flies kill the horses. And let's face it, tsetse flies are pretty serious. And as he pointed out, malaria killed vastly more people. David Livingstone, by the way, is the first person to have identified mosquitoes as the cause of malaria. And he was decades ahead of the medical and scientific community. He was ridiculed for this. Like the very etymology of the word, malaria. Mal, bad, area, air. Malaria, bad air. Malaria is swamp fever. Malaria is caused by bad air that comes out of swamps. Solution is high roofs. How on earth could an insect have anything to do with malaria? Preposterous. And David Livingstone was scorned for his believing and documenting that mosquitoes cause malaria. He went further than that. He said, it's the pregnant female mosquito that gives you malaria. You may be bitten by male mosquitoes during the daytime, but you'll only get malaria between 11 at night and about 5 in the morning if you're not under your mosquito net, because, which he kind of pioneered, because it's only the pregnant mosquitoes at night, in the midnight hours, that give you malaria. You're going to get mosquito bites, but you won't get malaria. And he'd been proven right. He was decades ahead of the rest of the people on this. Mosquitoes cause malaria. I mean, you know it now, but they didn't believe it back then. When I was growing up in Rhodesia, we would have Livingstone's Rouser, quinine. That's how you treated malaria. And malaria is normal, like tick bite fever and bilharzia. It's like, yeah, you get these things growing up in Rhodesia, all that sort of thing. So Livingstone's Rouser kept us healthy. And notice the quinine. Well, Livingstone happened to have pioneered not only identifying what causes malaria, but the cure to it, quinine. Quinine comes from a bush that you get in the Amazon jungle. It comes from South America. So how on earth did a missionary to Africa, from Scotland to Africa, discover a Brazilian tree? Well, a storm split a mast of the ship that he is coming down, the George, as it was coming across the Atlantic, and they were forced to cross over into South America, into Rio de Janeiro Harbor, to find a new mast. And so they had to hunt in the Amazon jungle to find some. Back then, the Amazon jungle stretched all the way to the coast. So while they were looking for a mast, he was, as always, taking different clippings and documenting and diagnosing, and later in Africa, he planted clippings from the quinine bush in Africa. And he found that, in fact, that was the perfect solution to malaria, because he kept trying all the different recipes out there, and he really treats himself like a guinea pig. He can mark down his symptoms and how he responded to it. It's quite interesting. I mean, a real scientist. What a medical doctor. Guinea pigs himself. But that's how he survived in Africa 24 years, whereas most people died in a matter of a few years through things like malaria, because he worked out the solution. David Livingstone teaches us that actions speak louder than words. He was described as the man of resolute courage. Fire, water, stone wall would not stop Livingstone the fulfillment of any recognized duty, wrote one of his contemporaries. Indeed, he did not let swamps or rivers or deserts or mountains prevent him from opening up Africa to the gospel. David Livingstone was determined to make a difference. The Great Commission was his supreme ambition. Christ's last command was his first concern. He wrote, I hope to be permitted to work as long as I live beyond other men's line of things and plant the seed of the gospel where others have not planted. I am a missionary, heart and soul. God had known his son, and he was a missionary and a physician. a poor imitation of whom I am or wish to be. In his service I hope to live, and in it I wish to die. I shall open up a path into the interior, or I will perish. May God bless us and make us blessings even unto death, he wrote. Shame upon us missionaries if we to be outdone by slave traders. If slave traders can get there, why can't we? Battling rains and chronic discomfort, rust and mildew and rot. Totally drenched in fatigue, laid low by fever countless times, over 60 times. Livingstone continued to persevere across the continent. Trials tested the tenacity of the travel-weary team. Often Livingstone endured excessive and unnecessary suffering and deprivation, hacking through dense jungle on foot because lack of funds prevented him from affording the luxury of a canoe. I would have hardly thought a canoe is a luxury. These privations, he wrote, I beg you to observe, are not sacrifices. I think that word ought never to be mentioned in reference to anything we can do for him, who though he was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor. The challenge of Livingstone rings out to us today. Can that be called a sacrifice, which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather it is a privilege. David Livingstone emphasized that sacrificial service is more powerful than eloquent sermons. We need to put feet to our faith. Livingstone also alerted the world to the cancerous sore of the Islamic slave trade. It was missionary explorer David Livingstone whose graphic descriptions brought the ravages of the East African slave trade to light. In his missionary travels, a narrative of an expedition to the Zambezi, he exposed the horrors of the slave trade. Two of the women had been shot the day before for attempting to untie their thongs. One woman had her infant's brains knocked out because she could not carry her load and the baby. A man was dispatched with an axe because he had broken down with fatigue. Those taken out of the country are but a very small section of the sufferers. We never realized the atrocious nature of the traffic until we saw it at its fountainhead. There truly Satan has his seat. Besides those actually captured, thousands are killed and die of their wounds and famine, driven from their villages by internecine war, waged for slaves with their own clansmen and neighbors, slain by the lust of gain, which is stimulated, be it remembered always, by the slave purchasers of Cuba and elsewhere. That's what Livingstone wrote. David Livingstone taught you cannot be neutral in the battlefields of life. He had the courage to confront evil. His fearless faith fought the good fight of faith. He set many thousands of captives free. Submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. David Livingstone is an example of extraordinary patience and perseverance. He overcame every obstacle. He walked across the continent of Africa. He walked from Delgo Bay, present-day Port Elizabeth, all the way up through Graaff-Reinet, which he called the prettiest town in Africa, and where he stayed at the home of Andrew Murray. Not that Andrew Murray Jr. was there. His father was there. Andrew Murray was studying in Scotland at the time. But he was in Andrew Murray's home in Kuruman, the manse. He went all in Graaff-Reinet. He went up to Kuruman, Robert Moffat's mission, London Missionary Society mission, in what is today the Northern Cape. He walked across today what is Botswana. He walked all the way back across the Cape Colony to Cape Town to place his family on a ship to return to Britain. It's impressive enough to cycle to Cape Town on good roads today. But imagine walking before their bridges and roads. He walked from Cape Town across the whole of the Cape Province throughout what is today Botswana, Zambia and Angola to the port of Luanda. He walked across from the Atlantic Ocean, across the continent of Africa, crossing what is today Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe and Mozambique to the Indian Ocean. And on the way, he marked an ideal cross-section across South and Central Africa, showing the elevations and the different terrains and the different types of soils and vegetation all along it. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He came back and he explored much of the Zambezi River, the Nashiri River, and the Rovuma River. He walked across much of what is today Mozambique and Malawi and Tanzania and Zimbabwe. Yet in all these things we're more than conquerors through him who loved us. On his third great missionary journey, he walked across the whole length of Tanzania, much of Mozambique and Malawi, Zambia, the Congo, Burundi, and he finally died on his knees in prayer in the province of Luapula in northern Zambia. In his 30 years of dedicated missionary service in Africa, he walked from coast to coast across what today are 12 vast countries. He walked across a continent that did not yet have roads, bridges, or purified water. I shall try to hold myself in readiness to go anywhere, provided it be forwards. David Livingstone teaches us the power of the printed page. It was books that he read, such as Practical Christianity by William Wilberforce, which challenged and channeled much of his life in dedicated labors to eradicate the slave trade and open up Africa for the gospel. Livingstone's missionary travels, the Zambezi expedition, and his journals, which inspired generations of missionaries to dedicate their lives to winning Africa for Christ. It was Livingstone's steadfast example which inspired Mary Slessor to devote her life to Calabar, present-day Nigeria. And I might add, if you think Livingstone was poor, Mary Slessor was poorer. David Livingstone at least had a father who loved him. Mary Slessor didn't even have that. She had a drunken, abusive father. She had to be earning money to keep her family alive from age 10. And Peter Cameron to launch the Africa Inland Mission. Peter Cameron returned from Africa in failure after his first mission. But when he read the inscription on the tomb of David Livingstone in Westminster Abbey, "Other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice." Cameron was rebuked, inspired, and resolved to return to Africa. And African Land Mission became African Land Church, one of the biggest missions in Africa, and one of the most influential churches in East Africa today. If you've been to Westminster Abbey, you might notice, like when they've got major weddings, like Catherine and William, you'll notice the red carpet goes all along, but there's a gap where it goes around. That's about where David Livingstone's grave is, his tomb. And so, on his tomb are these words in Westminster Abbey, premier spot. Livingstone knew the power of the printed page. He knew the power of public speaking tours. He focused on universities as strategic for mobilizing reformers and missionaries to fulfill the Great Commission. Livingstone saw rivers not as obstacles, but as God's highway to reach Africa for Christ. Because all communities need access to water, rivers are a strategic artery which missionaries should utilize to fulfill the Great Commission. David Livingstone believed in leadership training. His vision was actually to establish a Bible college or Bible colleges for Africans to be trained as evangelists and teachers and missionaries to disciple the nations. His mission leaders overruled it as unrealistic. Well, that freed him up to go and deal a death blow to the slave trade. The life and legacy of David Livingstone has taught me the importance of discipline, exercise, reading, a Christian work ethic, temperance, self-control, self-denial, and to be duty-orientated. His reformed theology has put doctrinal steel in my backbone. He has taught me the importance of being a man of my word, a person of integrity, and most important, a student of God's word. The post-millennial eschatology of victory of David Livingstone has inspired me that we are not working at uncertainty. The Lord who gave us the Great Commission will ensure that it is fulfilled. The Great Commission includes great promises of power from God. His promises and his power are fully sufficient to empower his church to fulfill his Great Commission, making disciples of all nations and teaching obedience to all things that he has commanded. David Livingstone's comprehensive vision of fulfilling the Great Commission, ministering to body, mind, and spirit, has raised the standard of missionary service for all of us. It is a rebuke to religious tourism. Actions speak louder than words. Sacrificial service is more powerful than eloquent sermons. We must put feet to our faith. We must recognize that we're in a world war of worldviews. And think of this picture. Diamonds. You know, David Livingstone was in that whole area. Kuruman is not far from Kimberley, and he walked and ministered around those areas. And being a very observant person who loved geology, he found diamonds, big ones, precious, valuable ones, and he threw them in a bush and said nothing about it for decades. Well, decades later, as the only two white men in all of Equatorial Africa from the Zambezi to the Nile met, Henry Morton Stanley walked deliberately towards the older man, took off his hat and said, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." "Yes," said David Livingstone. He lifted his cap slightly. Stanley shook hands and declared, "I thank God, Doctor, that I've been permitted to see you." Livingstone responded, "I feel thankful that I'm here to welcome you." And Stanley offered Livingstone a packet of letters from his family and his friends at home, expecting to read them immediately. But Livingstone put the letters to one side and said, "As I've waited years for these letters, I've been taught patience. I can afford to wait a few hours longer." Now, he hadn't seen a letter in 18 months. "Now tell me the general news. How's the war getting on?" he asked. Well, he's asking a journalist. So Stanley gave him an update, an opening of the Suez Canal, General Grant now President of the United States, the Pacific Railroad across the continent of America has been completed. Prussia has defeated Denmark and France in war. The first transatlantic cable has been laid, permitting immediate communication between North America and Europe. And diamonds have been discovered in South Africa. Kimberley, Northern Cape. Livingstone nods. "I wondered how long it would take them," he said. "What? What do you mean?" "No, he knew there were diamonds there, all along, for decades. Why didn't you sell them?" "I couldn't do that," he said. "We're trying to evangelize the Tswana people. We couldn't have gold, a diamond rush coming in and all these miners and the secularism, the drunkenness and vice. It would ruin our whole mission of winning the Tswana people to Christ. They weren't ready and to face all those temptations." "Well, couldn't you have taken those diamonds home and sold them back in Scotland or England?" "No," he said. "These diamonds are so valuable. People knew where I worked. They would have torn the country apart looking for these diamonds." So how about that? He had found the pearl of great price. He wasn't going to stoop to diamonds. He threw the diamonds back in the bush and said nothing about it. Can you imagine? How's that for focus? How's that for refusing to be distracted from the main thing? Keeping the main thing the main thing. And as you can see, people came from all over the world and they tore the place apart to find those diamonds and create the biggest hole the world had ever seen up to that stage. Islam is a threat to faith and freedom. You cannot be neutral. Confront evil. Fight the good fight of faith. Be bold. Be brave. Be courageous. Be patient. Persevere. Be steadfast. Overcome every obstacle. Obstacles are only there to be overcome. Go forward in the faith. Never forget the power of the printed page. Invest in books. Invest in your mind. You know, most people spend more time on their feet than they do on their brain. The average person spends more money on their shoes than they do on books. Read. Teach your people to love reading. Readers make leaders. A reading Christian is a growing Christian. And do not forget the schools, the colleges, and the universities. They are strategic. We must disciple the next generation to be faithful to God's word and effective in God's service. Think strategically about how to reach the nations for Christ. Make your life count for eternity. In the words of C.T. Studd, another great missionary, "Only one life, it'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last." And as William Carey, the father of modern mission, said, "Expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. God is great. Honor him with great faith." So, what would David Livingstone say to us today? "I beg to direct your attention to Africa," he said. "I know that in a few years I shall be cut off from that country, which is now open. Do not let it be shut again. I go back to Africa to try and make an open path for commerce and Christianity. Will you carry out the work which I have begun? I'll leave it with you. Also heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send? Who will go for us?' And I said, 'Here am I, Lord, send me.'" This message will be on the Frontline Mission SH.org website. It's the first chapter of the Great Commission Handbook, which you will be given tonight. David Livingstone is one of the 19 missionary chapters I've got in the Great Essential Missions book, which will also be given to you. This is a textbook, 19 biographies of 19 missionaries of the 19th century. This is one of the examples of excellence that I hope will inspire us as we put feet to our faith. Our vision is Africa for Christ. We formed back in 2006 Livingstone Fellowship. And this is Livingstone House here with a goal. And we put sermons and Bible studies and in many different languages and digital evangelism resources and tracks, audio and video on Livingstone Fellowship. This is Because we found Frontline Fellowship Web was banned, blocked in many countries, Muslim and communist countries. So I saw the need to start a new one that would only have sermons and Bible studies, and people from South Africa have gone to the Arab Emirates and others have found while Frontline Fellowship's blocked, Livingston Fellowship isn't. So we continue to use that as our primary vehicle for sermons and Bible studies. As we approached 2013, I realized this is the 200th anniversary of the birth of David Livingston. And so we organized the Livingston 200. And we set up the Livingston 200 website. And I set up the Facebook page, Dr. David Livingston. And it's actually quite a dynamic page. You'll find a lot of interesting posts on it. And of course, our mission headquarters is called Livingston House, named after Livingston for obvious reasons. I think after hearing this presentation, you understand why we've named this mission base after the greatest missionary, the best friend Africa's ever had. There are monuments to David Livingston all over Scotland, obviously, you'd understand that, sowing the good seed, one of Scotland's most famous sons. Interestingly, do you know that at the birthday of David Livingston in 2013, 200th birthday, the president of Malawi went to Blantyre, to the Livingston Museum, to thank the people of Scotland for lending their son, David Livingston, to Malawi. And so it's understandable that there are monuments to him in Scotland. This is a very unfair memorial. I think this puts the line in a very bad light. Honestly, while I'm a friend and fan of David Livingston, Livingston was wrong on this occasion. He should have left the line alone. And no line attacked him in the rest of his 26 years in Africa, but, you know, the only line that ever attacked him was one he shot first. He drew first blood, and, you know, leave the line alone, he'll leave you alone. So this, what I don't like about this monument is there's no sign of the rifle of David Livingston there. This is dishonest. It makes it look like the lion just attacked someone. You know, if it had the rifle in his hand, okay, maybe. But I think this is bad PR for lions. I say that as somebody, some of my best friends growing up was a lion. And I must say, while I like David Livingston, I think he admit himself was the dumbest thing he ever did. Picking a fight with a lion. Leave the line alone. This is in Ujiji. If you go up to Tanzania on Lake Tanganyika, you get under the mango tree which then stood here. Henry Morton Stanley met David Livingston 10th of November 1871. And Zambia put out a postage stamp on the anniversary, the centenary of the death of David Livingston, 1977. They put out this stamp showing David Livingston chasing the Muslim slave raiders out of Zambia. What a lovely stamp, lovely memorial. You go to Zambia, northern Zambia, they've got at Chitambo's village the memorial that David Livingston died here. And there's a memorial, a big memorial, over where the tree used to be that under which his heart was buried. Now, this monument occupies a spot where formerly stood the tree at the foot of which Livingston's heart was buried by his faithful native followers. On the trunk was carved the following: David Livingston, 4th of May, 1973, Chuma Suzi. And, in fact, they'd mistaken the date. It wasn't the 4th of May, it was discovered later, it was the 1st of May. It was just a miscalculation which was worked out from the diaries later. But that's what was written, 4th of May. Interestingly enough, some of the wood from the tree under which Livingston's heart was buried ended up in Zanzibar. And it's on the cross, on the high altar. In Zanzibar, built over where the old slave market used to be. We've got a whole lot of first editions of David Livingston's books here at the mission. Some of our treasured possessions, crown jewels, so to speak, in a mission named after David Livingston. And these are magnificent first editions, and these have got a lot of the pictures that you saw in this presentation. We scanned out of those books and documents, which makes them extremely valuable and helpful. And so there's a lot of good books on Livingston, and now we've produced audios and videos and school textbooks. When we went in 2013 to Livingston, the town of Livingston, the city of Livingston in Zambia, on the Zambian side of the Victoria Falls, we saw 8 different memorials to David Livingston in one city. Some magnificent memorials. David Livingston High School, Livingston Museum, and erected in 2005 on the Zambian side in commemoration of the 150th anniversary of Livingston discovering and naming and measuring Victoria Falls. In 2011, I think it was, just before I went there for the 2013 Livingston 200, they had a new monument at the Livingston International Airport to commemorate David Livingston and his two faithful followers, Susie and Truma, with his Bible in his hand. You can find other places in Zambia where they've got a memorial under this tree David Livingston rested. And so these are some of the designs that we made, Livingston 200, to commemorate this great man. This is why, from this mission station, we've sent our teams that have gone celebrating Livingston 200. We went over 7 months across the 12 countries where Livingston went, but we cheated, we drove. Yeah, I mean, you couldn't do it in that time period if we didn't drive. And I must say, I've often said to our people who complain about the bad roads, I said, remember, we drive where Livingston walks. And so there's not much for us to complain about. But we distributed 3.5 tons of Bibles and books during Livingston 200 amongst people who were the descendants of those who had received the gospel first preached in the area by David Livingston on the 200th anniversary of his birth. So that's just part of Livingston bicentenary. And it ended with us having a Livingston 200 missions conference in the city of Livingston, which was covered by radio and TV of Zambia, national TV and local TV of Livingston. The mayor's office was there. And this is, I must say, it was a blazing hot summer's day. This is the Livingston Teachers Training College in Zambia, in Livingston. Here we've got national TV and local Livingston TV covering us at the Livingston Centenary. You can see a lot of people have got their umbrellas up. And I had several people come saying, don't you want to take your jacket off? And I said, no, I don't think I can honour David Livingston by taking my jacket off on this day. One lady offered to come stand holding an umbrella over me. I said, I don't think that would be right. I can't believe that it would be right for me to preach in the shade when we are commemorating David Livingston on this day. This is the Anglican Church downtown, which was planted in memory of David Livingston. And so on the Sunday, I led a church service. In fact, I had several services there. And some of the audios of the week of ministry are commemorated in this Livingston 200 Missions Conference MP3. By the way, what your boots look like when you've walked across the continent. Livingston's signature as well. And, of course, we've got the websites, Livingston 200. And you can get a taste of him by just reading one chapter, a foretaste, a small little chapter in the Greater Century of Missions. So, questions, comments on what would David Livingston say to us today? Questions, comments, complaints? Wonderful to have someone here from Zambia and Zimbabwe, two countries greatly that honour Livingston, and Malawi, of course. Three countries that seem to have remembered Livingston the most and the best. Probably better than Scotland, too.
Just a question on when he didn't want to leave his men, because he was afraid if they returned themselves, they would be
captured, enslaved, right. Yeah, could be.
So what made him think that if he was there, they wouldn't just throw him in the...
He had double-barreled rifle, six-barreled revolver. I think it could have been that. Also, remember, he knew, because he knew how to work the sextant and he was plotting by the stars, he was able to find his way back easier. They might have had more chance of getting lost. So I think it could have been his map-making abilities, direction-finding abilities, but the fact that he would fight for them, I think, that would be the main protection. They would have had spears and could be easily outnumbered.
Would the slave traders would have been had they feared him or respected him because he was European and maybe...
Probably, yes. I think that would also be a factor because, remember, the European powers were outlawing slavery. The Royal Navy was fighting the slave trade throughout the Atlantic. But they weren't involved in the Indian Ocean. They were basically ignoring. They turned a blind eye to the slavery going on in Central and East Africa and up the Red Sea and the east coast of Africa. So it's Livingston who really sound the alarm. And Henry Morton Stanley did even more afterwards to get the British to finally close down the slave trade in Zanzibar. And in fact, it's entered into the Guinness Book of Records some years back, for several years, I don't know if it still is, that Livingston and Henry Morton Stanley inspired the shortest war in history. When the word came out that Livingstone had died, there was great grief in Britain that they had abandoned their mission. And it took an American to resupply him and get his journals and story out. And they felt the only thing they could do to honor him, which Henry Morton Stanley prompted them to, was to declare war on Zanzibar and close down the slave market. And so the Sultan was given an ultimatum from the Royal Navy, close the slave market. And when he refused, they shelled the palace, and within half an hour, the white flag came up and they surrendered. Half an hour, the half an hour war, the shortest war in history in the Guinness Book of Records, inspired by Livingstone Stanley to end the slave trade in Zanzibar. And then they put a hulking great big Christ Cathedral, is what it's called, on top of the old slave market in Zanzibar, where it still is. I mean, that was probably one of the best wars ever for a righteous cause, and it had good fruit. Because the slave terminus in Zanzibar was massive. They processed, I'm forgetting what the quantities was, but it was absolutely horrendous. Something like maybe 20,000 slaves a month, something like that. It was huge. So Zanzibar was the hub, and the Royal Navy was turning a blind eye. And it's only Henry Morton Stanley publishing Livingstone's works that finally made them do that out of guilt. Because, do you know, Livingstone, after his first missionary journey, he came to Britain, and he was received with great honors. And the Queen received him, and he got gold medal from the Royal Geographic Society, and you know, all the universities opened up to him. That's after his first missionary journey. Second missionary journey, came back, nobody met him. Nobody wanted to see him. He's yesterday's hero. He's embarrassing. Because everyone on his second team, who were Europeans, gave up, came back, bad-mouthed him. Even his own brother Charles. They all spoke against him. Even, sadly, the artist Thomas Baines. I mean, they said, Livingstone's impossible to work with, and so on and so forth. Funny, the Africans had no problem with Livingstone, but the Europeans never managed to work with him. No Europeans stayed in the field with him for long. They all gave up. So when Livingstone came back, he was assumed guilty because nobody had heard his side. He was too busy working in Africa. He comes back. Nobody welcomed him in. And when he left in his third and last missionary journey, nobody saw him off at the harbor. Board the ship on his own, left. Nobody to wave goodbye to anything like that. If it wasn't for an American journalist, Henry Morton Stanley, he would have died unknown in Africa. Stanley brought him the supplies when he was at his lowest ebb, when he had nothing, when everything had been stolen from him. He had no medicines, no food, nothing. And at that point, Stanley turns up. And then, through his writings, revives people's interest. So when Livingstone died, the British people felt serious guilt. And the only way they could honor Livingstone at that stage was in the slave trade in the Indian Ocean. So, interesting. Yes?
One question. You mentioned certain words regarding Livingstone's theology, such as post-millennial Calvinism and eschatology. Could you please clarify that? Like the victory of the post-modern eschatology or something?
Yes. So, I mean, Livingstone was congregational. His family was congregational. They were strongly reformed. They believed in congregational self-government. They walked to another town or village, hours out of town of their town, because there wasn't a reformed enough church in their town. And they thought the Presbyterian church in the 1830s was too liberal. Can you imagine? So they were going to a far more reformed church and missionary-minded church. And I mean, reading about that's fascinating enough. But so Livingstone himself was solidly reformed from a very strongly reformed family. But his eschatology of victory was the Great Commission will be fulfilled. God will ensure the Great Commission is fulfilled before he returns. So he went out in absolute assurance that the Great Commission will be successful. God, who gave the Great Commission, will enable it to be fulfilled. So he went out with that rock-solid assurance. And he believed in the sovereignty of God. He had such a strong Calvinist view. And that's what made him able to handle it all. Because, I mean, imagine, he buried one of his daughters in Africa. He buried his wife in Africa, in Zambezi Valley. Graves in Mozambique, we've been there. And he never got bitter. He didn't get resentful. Despite so many things going against him, even all of his co-workers turning against him, he stayed firm. And so how could you do that unless you believe in the sovereignty of God? And I mean, that's the thing. Calvinism does make strong faith for hard times. And the Scottish people tend to be harder people and tougher people, at least they used to be. Any other question you got about that? Did I answer what you were asking?
Well, I think I have to go look in the dictionary because I understand all the words exactly, but I just like to get like the dictionary definitions from my own interest.
Oh, okay. Well, which word do you want me to explain a bit better?
Like, I'm not sure what you mean by reform or by Calvinist.
Okay, so if you take the Protestant churches, you've got those who reformed, who believe strongly in the sovereignty of God, and then you've got those who are Arminian, who believe more that you can lose your salvation, and they've got a different view. So, for example, the Reformation faith is well depicted in the five solas on that window as you come up under the Luther Rose. Sola Scriptura, Scripture alone is the ultimate authority. Sola Gratia, salvation is by the grace of God alone. Sola Fide, salvation is received by faith alone. Solus Christus, Christ alone is the head of the church, and Soli Deo Gloria, everything must be done for the glory of God alone. So those would be some of the five key battle cries of the Reformation. So the thing that makes the Reformed faith so different from the Arminian faith is the idea that God saves sinners. God and God alone saves sinners. He saves sinners. He saves sinners. I mean, we don't earn our salvation. We don't, it's not that God looks at us and says, you know, I'd really like this person on my team. You know? It's that God in his mercy saves undeserving sinners by his grace. And I think that the thing about the Reformed faith is there's no room for pride, there's no room for boasting, because we recognize the depravity of man and we recognize the sovereignty of God. And that's why a lot of people hate Calvinism, because basically it's saying there's nothing good in us except what God by his grace puts it. We don't earn our salvation. We don't deserve our salvation. We are wicked, hell-deserving sinners, and only God saves us. So, the first time I met Dr. James Kendi of Evangelism Explosion, he said to me, Peter, what comes first? Repentance or regeneration? So what would you say?
Regeneration.
Correct. And when I said that, James Kendi said, you must be a Calvinist. Got up and shook my hand. Now, the average Christian today will say repentance comes before regeneration. But a reformed person will say regeneration comes before repentance. You go to Ephesians 2. Ephesians chapter 2 speaks about how that salvation is by the grace of God alone and received by faith alone, not of works lest any man should boast. So there's no room for pride. And so the idea that some people have that by my repentance, I buy my regeneration, or I earn my regeneration. It's almost like God made salvation possible, but I'm the one who appropriated and made it work. So, which also means I can resist God and his regeneration. So there's a whole lot involved in it, but the thing about Arminianism, for example, in the English Civil War, the Arminian bishops in England, like Archbishop Laud, were torturing Protestants. And they were doing so because they believed the Calvinist God is cruel. And yet the Arminians were doing a lot of cruelty to punish and to persecute the Calvinists. So it's a strange thing that the people who believe in the depravity of man often are involved in the greatest charity. And the people who believe in the goodness of man often are guilty of the worst thing. So take Zambia. Under Kenneth Kaunda was dictator, effectively, of Zambia for about 26 years, one-party state. His parents were Calvinists, and he said, I could never agree with my Calvinist parents. His parents were trained in Livingstonia in Malawi as evangelists. He said, I could never agree with my parents, Calvinism, which believed in the depravity of man. I don't believe in the depravity of man, wrote Kenneth Kaunda in his book Humanism, A Humanist in Africa. He said, I believe in the goodness of man. That's interesting, because he locked up his opponents in prison without trial. I ended up in one of his presidential detainee cells, because he believed in the goodness of man. And then the prison was mostly people who had never even seen their day in court. Some had been 8 years and hadn't had their day in court. They were remanded. They hadn't even been tried yet, because he believed in the goodness of man. That's just strange that a lot of humanism and Arminianism have some overlap. So anyway, historically, the Calvinists who believe in the depravity of man and the sovereignty of God have often been the ones fighting for the most liberty, because they don't trust them, they don't trust people. And so in the forefront of the fight for liberty through the ages, whether you're talking about Cromwell's roundheads or Ironsides, or you're talking about William of Orange's fighters for freedom in the Netherlands, the Covenanters of Scotland, they were Calvinists, and the Huguenots of France. So the Calvinists have been in the forefront of the fight for freedom and liberty because they don't believe in man's solutions, they don't trust man. And so Calvinism sounds harsh because it says there's nothing good in man. Man is totally depraved. And the Arminians often reject this and say, but we believe in the goodness of man. A man can choose the right thing, you know. We're good people at heart. I'm a very good person, you know. That kind of view comes from, it's kind of an Arminian view. So anyway, I hope that's not too much information.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's also what Jesus said, in the Bible, it says, apart from Jesus, there is no good in
him. Yes. No.
That is the truth.
So, one of my favorite entries into evangelism, especially with Americans, and they've taught a lot of people, so I can talk like that, is you ask them a question like, do you want some coffee or tea or something? And then answers often, no, I'm good. And so at this point you can say, when a person says, I'm good, but Jesus said, no one is good except God alone. And there you've got an opportunity to discuss the depravity of man, the need for salvation, the goodness of God. So how wonderful, our culture has now brainwashed people into giving an excuse to start an evangelist conversation. The moment a person says, I'm good, which is like every day, you come across people saying, I'm good. You can challenge them. It might seem obnoxious, but we can do it with a smile. Okay, any other comments? Observations? David Livingston.
Did I get you correctly when you say it properly? Frontline fellowship has been banned in some other countries.
Yes, our website is blocked. Our website's blocked.
Oh.
So some of our people end up in Muslim countries, like work in Saudi Arabia and so on. Can't get it. So yes, our website's got, because we publish slavery, terrorism, Islam. So I know people who've studied in China and said they can't reach the website. Our website's down. So we've got other websites that don't have the same high profile, so that they can get in. We got about 17 websites. Yes. Inamisa, you want to go first?
Okay. I just wanted to ask, like, most of the depictions and the paintings and drawings of when David Livingstone is fighting off the slave traders, it looks like it's African Muslims or what?
Yeah.
Color, or was it Arab Muslims?
He certainly fought the Arab Muslims too. But in Malawi, it was the Yao. The Yao tribe are like 100% Muslim, or they were at that time. We've got a good, strong Yao church these days. But the Yao people, he had some serious blows with, because they were the ones coming in and raiding the Malawian, Chichewa people, and the Bemba people, and Zambia, and so on. So, yes,
they were
Muslim, but they were African black Muslims. But then he also fought the Arab Muslims too, of course. So. Those are just some of the pictures I could find, but there's
so
no
were
doubt.
Converts, like
they were totally converted, and they were a slave raiding tribe. So the Yao people, for example, became, their job was, they enslaved other tribes and took them and sold them at the coast to the Arabs. Yeah, I'm afraid that's a horrible part of history.